Herbert Hoover was the 31st president of the United States. He served one term from 1929 to 1933, often considered placid, passive, and unsympathetic, even paralyzed by national events. Hoover faced an uphill battle in the face of the Great Depression. Many historians dismiss him as merely ineffective, but in the new book Herbert Hoover in the White House, investigative journalist Charles Rapley draws on rare and intimate sources, memoirs and diaries, and thousands of documents kept by members of his cabinet and close advisors, to reveal a very different figure than the one often portrayed. The real Hoover, argues Rapley, just lacked the tools of leadership. Engaged and active, but loath to experiment and conscious of his inability to convey hope to the country. The name again of the new book is Herbert Hoover in the White House, and we welcome Charles Rapley to the roundtable this morning. Charles, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thank you.
What brought you to Herbert Hoover?
Well, you know, I was looking for a project that wasn't in the founding era. My last two books were, my last book was Robert Morris, Financier of the American Revolution. And I talked with my editor, and we decided to look for a president who had been overlooked, which is sort of a curious combination. It's hard to be president and not be noticed, but Hoover was largely overshadowed by the events of his presidency and by his successor, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who, of course, was a giant on the historical stage. And Hoover, as a result, is curiously misunderstood, unknown, and it's sort of a gap in our understanding of presidents and of the progress of the American story.
Here is a president who, and you even note this, that it comes with a lot of baggage. So you wanted to take a more nuanced approach to looking at this man and try to remove some of that baggage.
Well, I felt that it was likely, and this is starting out, I mean, I was not versed in Hoover or particularly in the Depression, although economics has always been sort of a focus of mine. But certainly our understanding of Hoover was one-dimensional, that he was a failure, that everybody kind of agrees on that, and that he was kind of a stuffed shirt and he never made his connection with the American people. And beyond that, I thought, I felt like his story was not really understood. I knew I was not somebody who was familiar with it, and I was intrigued to see what was there, and I was rewarded, I feel like, in finding that there's a lot there, that it's really quite a fascinating story, and that there's a lot to learn from seeing this guy who we regard as sort of a stooge, but who in fact was quite a sophisticated character, an adroit manager, a consensus at the time of and the embodiment of competence and capability, how he came to be laid low by the historic circumstances of his presidency.
I want to talk about some of the successes and some of the things that you believe he should be credited for. But let us talk about the Great Depression. While many historians look at him and say that a lot of the blame can rest on his shoulders for the Great Depression, where do you come on that? Because in your writing of the book, that his understanding and his managing of the economy was really quite interesting. He had great insight.
Yes, he had insight. He had instinctive sort of understanding. He was a capitalist before he became a politician. His story is interesting. He was an orphan. He was penniless and abandoned by circumstance. He fell in with an uncle in Oregon who was a land speculator. Hoover literally in his teenage years slept behind the desk at the land office and taught himself mathematics and some of the other skills that he developed. He was discovered by a recruiter for the first class at Stanford University and became a member of that first class, managed to graduate, and went on to a career as an international geological mining consultant. Became a millionaire by the age of 40 at a time when $1 million was really $1 million. And so when he came to public attention in World War I as a philanthropist, he was in Europe and he became an organizer in Belgian relief, bringing food aid to neutral countries caught up in World War I. That brought him to public attention. He was considered a principal advisor to the peace mission in Paris in the armistice after World War I, and then was brought into the cabinet to introduce to United States sort of political activity as a member of the Warren Harding cabinet as Secretary of Commerce. And so for 7 years after World War I, he was Secretary of Commerce. He presided over what was probably the longest stretch of economic boom times in the history of the United States, which is the Roaring Twenties. And having presided over all of this, he was considered the odds-on candidate, the natural choice to succeed Calvin Coolidge as president of the United States. And it's sort of ironic because Hoover was not a natural politician. He made very few speeches. He made 7 speeches in the entirety of his campaign for president, 5 major ones. And in between those speeches, he wouldn't talk to reporters. He didn't give press conferences. He didn't speak from train platforms the way his rival Al Smith did. He was not well liked by the reporters who covered him, but he was elected as a competent manager, an antidote to sort of the crazy times of the Roaring Twenties. The idea that the Depression was Hoover's fault is really unfounded. It's clear what happened with the Depression, that the run-up of prices and speculation during the boom years of the 20s, much like during the boom years of the 2000s, led to the collapse of 2008 and 2009. The boom years of the 20s led to the collapse of asset prices and the ensuing Depression. Hoover was elected in March of, or took office in March of 1929. The crash didn't happen until October. And when the Wall Street crash happened in October, that's when the Depression kind of revealed itself. Nobody, again, like 2009 or 2008, nobody anticipated anything like the Depression coming. And when it did hit, it took most people by surprise. And in that instance, Hoover's reaction was he recognized immediately that this was a very serious challenge. He immediately put out notices to his department heads in the government asking them to prepare plans for ramping up government spending, for counter-cyclical activity, for efforts to damp down the unemployment that he was sure was coming. He responded, but not successfully. The Depression was simply too big to turn around.
One of the points that you make in the book, one of the arguments, is that Hoover had a first-class mind but a second-class temperament. You talk about his character, and a lot of this grew out of the fact that he grew up a penniless orphan. Even though he found success, he never lost those feelings of loneliness and isolation, and he had trouble in that role as commander-in-chief.
Well, yes, he had this unusual sort of character of feeling aloof and distant from people, but always wanting to be surrounded by them. Somebody called him a gregarious hermit. It's hard to sort of encapsulate the contradictions involved, but he was a very conflicted person. He really needed people around him, but he resented that very sort of neediness, and he tried to act as if those people were not important to him, and the result was it was difficult to work for him. He had trouble showing loyalty, and especially in the role of being a public leader as he was, he hated public appearances. He hated the things you had to do to court public favor. He didn't like kissing babies. He didn't like meeting with large groups of people who he didn't know. He resented it all the time. He also didn't like public speaking. He was a very poor public speaker. So you had this time when politics turned on the speeches and the oratory of these great figures, and you had Hoover stiff and inhibited at the microphone, so that when it came to policy, Hoover was often very sophisticated and appropriate in his responses. But when it came to leading the country, when it came to particularly a country that was suffering and needed to feel that the government was on their side, Hoover was incapable of giving that reassurance to people. It was a personal thing, and it just wasn't in him. And he was aware of it. He talked about it on occasion. He said, "I'm just not the showman that I need to be. I'll never be a Teddy Roosevelt." And that was sort of people. Not only was he anguished by his inability to respond, but it was people could see it. They could read it in his face, in his expressions. And it had to be disconcerting to have a president, and it was, people talked about it at the time, to have a president who was called upon to sort of respond to his public and simply couldn't muster that kind of emotional connection. So I think part of what you see when you look at Hoover in the White House is how important it is to actually be a politician. When he was elected, there was a conscious effort to identify him as the non-politician, sort of like what we get with Trump, you know, a guy who's from outside the system and Hoover is very different than Donald Trump. But I think when you look at the question of being a politician and whether that's an asset or not, the example of Hoover suggests that being a politician is, in fact, a very important part of the job of being a Democratic elected leader.
That's a great point, and I think it was also interesting in the book to realize that even in Hoover's time, voters were still skeptical of quote-unquote politicians.
Yes, and I think that's actually, it goes way back. I think it goes to that old tradition of in the early years of the Republic, people wouldn't announce themselves as a candidate. They would go through these elaborate rituals of having other people name them and then sort of reluctantly acceding to the demand that they run for a particular office. There's always been that sense that, oh, politicians are hucksters and they'll say whatever they have to say to get elected, when in fact, you know, that's part of the process, and we need to hear from people as to what they're going to do and why they're going to do it and get a sense of whether we can trust them or not. It's just part of the game.
The book is fascinating. It's entitled Herbert Hoover in the White House, The Ordeal of the Presidency. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Charles Rapley, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much.
The name again of the book is Herbert Hoover in the White House, The Ordeal of the Presidency. Charles Rapley is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.